We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbeam, and wherever you find your podcasts. If you're always ready to give, to care, and to go out of your way to keep things nice, wouldn't you make a great partner? The problem being a people pleaser, says my witness today, is nobody gets pleased. I thought, what a great topic for a podcast. I met Dr. Robert Glover at Mannsein, an international conference for men in Berlin. He's a therapist, dating coach, and author of the classic self-help book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, a proven plan for getting what you want in love, sex, and relationships. I believe that people-pleasing is an equal opportunities problem, so we'll be widening the topic to cover how both men and women can fall into this trap. So, what skin have you got in the people-pleasing game, Robert?
Andrew, I love it when you said that when a person's trying to please, nobody gets pleased. What a great way to put it. My skin in the game. I've never been asked it quite that way before. I am a recovering people pleaser. I tell people that, you know, my book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, is my autobiography. I just use other guys' stories to tell my own. And you're right. This was probably one of the first works where anybody addressed people pleasing, codependency, and men. Prior to that, it had primarily been thought of as the realm of women. And the term even codependency comes out of, you know, mainly addictions is where it started, where a partner that's, you know, enabling an addictive partner and getting their identity through that addictive partner. So yeah, the whole idea of people pleasing, codependency, it's a nice guy and a nice girl issue. And again, I love it. When you're trying to please, nobody gets pleased.
So give me an example of yourself in your old days when you were people-pleasing. What was your life like?
Let's see. That's about 30-something years of my life. Let me pick a good slice of that one. You know, I was raised to be a people-pleaser from a number of sources. You know, and primarily, probably part of it was just my natural temperament is that, you know, I like to go along to get along. I'm not the person that likes conflict. My mother used to tell women I was dating, Bobby never did like conflict. I'm thinking, who likes conflict? But I tend to be attracted to women who do. It seems like all the women in my life have liked fighting and liked having conflict. And, you know, that so the people pleaser in me would do things to avoid the conflict, not bring things up, not share an opinion, not say if I was upset, not say if I wanted something I wasn't getting. I would just keep all of that in. And then, you know, subtly using what I call covert contracts, try to manipulate the person or the situation to give me what I wanted without me ever asking clearly or saying, I want this, or I'm upset, or I don't like the way this is going on. I would keep that in. I remember a few times with my second wife, where that's where I actually began, started making the transition from nice guy to recovering nice guy. And that was the relationship I was in when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy. I'd keep something in, and it'd either come out in passive-aggressive ways, you know, put down, not following through on something I said I'd do, maybe not telling the whole truth, or I'd just blow up in what my ex used to call victim pukes. And then, you know, so I'd blow up about something, and it would not be pretty. And then afterwards, when we finally got through it, she said, how long has that been bothering you? I go, oh, I don't know, 6 months or so, maybe. And she said, it never dawned on you to just bring it up? And I go, no, actually, that never even crossed my mind, that I could actually just bring that up and we could talk about it. Because my thought, if I bring it up, it's bound to start a fight. And so I wouldn't. So there's a, you know, really clear example of the people pleasing, not pleasing anybody, and that avoidance of conflict and just wanting everything to be calm and smooth all the time.
So the belief of nice guys and people pleasers in general is, if I'm good, giving and caring, they will be happy, loved and fulfilled. And then I will be happy, loved and fulfilled too.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds perfectly possible, But what's wrong with this?
Well, I thought it was possible too. And I think most nice guys do. You know, for most of my life, you know, well, say the first 30 something years of my life, if you met me, I might even tell you, I'm a nice guy. I'm one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And I thought because, you know, I was different from my father, who was pretty self-centered and moody and narcissistic. And I was different from all the other men I heard women complain about. Oh, they only want one thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I thought because I was different that would make women attracted to me. It let me have a smooth, problem-free world. And the problem is the nice guy paradigm based on two primary things. One is trying to become what I think other people want me to be, so I'll be liked and loved and get my needs met. And two, hiding anything about me that might get a negative reaction that I anticipate might get a negative reaction, might start a fight, might get me rejected, might get me hurt, left, abandoned. Living with that paradigm doesn't get those wanted needs met. It doesn't attract people to you. It doesn't make people around you happy. It doesn't keep things smooth and problem free. But we believe it should, right? Most nice guys think, I'm following the rules. I'm doing it right. Look, I've got this scoreboard here. Look, all the good things I've done. I've got a bank account full of good deeds. That should buy me a lot of grace, right? Nobody should ever be upset at me, call me out, tell me I did it wrong, be mad at me. Things should go well. And that's just not the way that life works. But we think it should.
Can I give you a little hint?
I love hints.
Your partner is not a mind reader.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. All right. Let's talk about covert contracts. Are you okay with that?
Yep, sure.
Because you've teed it up. In No More Mr. Nice Guy, I talk about three basic covert contracts. And I'll even present them even clearer here than I do in the book. Nice guys and nice girls. So people pleasers. These people that are seeking external validation, hiding anything about them because they think that might, you know, cause them to be unloved or unliked or get abandoned, have three basic covert contracts. Number one is that if I'm a good guy, then I will be liked and loved. Now, one thing I see a lot in men, we can tack onto that, and the person I want to have sex with me will want to have sex with me too, because I'm a good guy, right? I listen to her talk about her problems. I do nice things for her. I treat her better than her ex that she keeps complaining about, but going back to, you know, I made her car payment for her. I helped her sister move. She should like me and love me and want to have sex with me, even though I completely have hidden my sexual intentions and sexual agenda from her. She should read my mind and know. Okay? That's covert contract number one. And these are all manipulative. They're all giving to get. They all have strings attached. And as the name implies, they're covert. Often the nice guy is even unconscious to the contracts, and so is everybody else. So covert contract number two, here's the mind reading one. If I read your mind and give to you what I think you want or need without you having to ask, then you will read my mind and give to me what I want and need without me having to ask. Now, a lot of problems with that. Of course, you don't know the contract exists. I'm not really reading your mind. I'm just giving to you out of, well, if I give this to you, you'll give something back. It's manipulation. You can't read my mind. And nice guys are actually terrible at letting people give to them. All the while, we give, and we want all this appreciation and maybe reciprocity. We don't let it in. We don't let it happen. And then covert contract number three for the nice guy syndrome is that if I do everything right, then I will have a smooth, problem-free life.
Now, good luck with that.
Good luck. Yeah, who gets everything right? You know, every great religious philosophical treatise basically says, you know, we all fall short. None of us get it right. And the second part is life is not smooth and problem-free. The cosmos is chaotic by nature, right? There's always everything's state of creation and entropy. So life is not smooth and problem-free. So it's kind of a Peter Pan-ish little boy. If I please mommy, then everything will go well and I'll get what I want.
So if you're not quite certain, I'm going to pick up some of the behaviors that Robert has mentioned that seem good, and then I'll get Robert to explain why they don't work. And then we'll look at some of the things that you are doing if you're a people pleaser that aren't good. So the behaviors that seem good is being a caretaker, approving of what other people do, avoiding conflict, not rocking the boat, want to be different from your father or your mother, repress feelings, and difficulty making your own needs a priority.
Yeah, that should work, right? All that should work, yeah?
So I'm going to go through the reasons why it's wrong, and I'd just like you to comment on them for me, please. Sure. The first one is it's dishonest.
And this is ironic. And actually, in my men's program, I'm teaching a series of lessons. And the one that I presented, I started last week and I'm teaching again tonight, is on honesty. And one of the things I say is that nice guys have an awkward relationship with honesty. While we're thinking we're good people, and good people tell the truth, right? Isn't that kind of what we would assume? So we think we're good people, and we are good people. We're just following a roadmap that doesn't work, right? And because we're trying to become what we think other people want us to be, that's not honest. That's not authentic. There's no integrity in that. It's a chameleon. And if we're hiding anything that might get a negative reaction, that leads to lots of dishonesty. So for example, when I started working on what I came to find out were my nice guy tendencies and my roadmap, one of the first things I had to start working on was my honesty, because if anything might upset anybody, I withheld it. So I might tell part of the truth, misdirect them, not bring something up. And so one thing I started doing with my then wife and other people around me, whenever I found myself cooking up some story or manipulating, massaging the truth in my head before a conversation, as soon as I caught it, because you can notice it. You can notice that, you know, if you're a habitual, not truth teller, habitual liar, you can start listening to that coach in your head telling you how to tell the lie. As soon as I would notice that, I'd go to my partner and I'd say, I was going to lie to you. Here's the lie I was going to tell you, and here's the whole truth. And you know what? When I was in those lying states, my partner was always upset about something. As soon as I started saying, I was going to lie to you, here's the lie, and here's the truth, they'd go, oh, okay, thanks for telling me the truth. And you know, they didn't get upset. And I'm thinking, why didn't somebody tell me that a long time ago?
Because what I find a lot with people pleasers is they're so focused on what the other person wants, they often don't actually know, because they've never checked in to actually know what their truth is.
Yeah. You're 100% right about that. And that's why I talk about integrity and differentiation, which I define as the ability to ask yourself, what do I want? What's true for me? What's right for me? I mean, that's our internal locus of control, our internal compass. And if you never ask yourself, what do I want? What's right for me? What's my truth? You're never in integrity, because you have to not only ask yourself that, but then live it, act on it. That's the only way to be a truly honest person.
The next thing that people do is they compartmentalize. Now, how does that work?
Yeah, that fits even really well with that whole honesty and integrity thing. And personally, I was really good that I could put things, you know, in such a deep compartment inside and lock it airtight where I didn't even look at it. So, for example, I might think I'm faithful to my partner, but yet I'm flirting with other women and liking their attention, and of course would not do that if my partner was present with me. And then we can tell ourselves, oh, I'm faithful, you know, I'm monogamous, but yet we're leaking sexual energy everywhere we go. So that's a really common pattern. Again, the whole truth-telling thing, like I said, I could cook up any story, mainly if my wife said, you know, what time are you going to be home for dinner? I'm at work. And I think, oh, she wants me home at this time. I better tell her 5 o'clock, because I think that's what she wants to hear. And then I knew I couldn't even leave my office till after 5. So on the way, I'm driving home, thinking up the story. Oh, there's lots of traffic, all the red lights, maybe an accident. And then I get home and she was upset, even no matter how good my story was. And the truth was, she said, I just want to know what time you're coming home so I know when to have dinner ready. You didn't have to tell me a certain time. But I would do all that and just keep it compartmentalized. That, oh yeah, I'm still a good guy and I'm basically honest, but I wasn't. And it is amazing how you just, you know, in psychology, I don't know if this is an apt illustration, but I remember in child development, children go through a developmental stage when they're pretty young. You know, you play peekaboo with them, and they can put something over their eyes, and they think if they can't see you, you can't see them. right? And it's a surprise to them at some developmental stage. Oh, you saw me all along, right? But it's kind of the same thing, you know, with nice guys and their compartmentalization. Oh, if you can't see the lie, I'm an honest person. Well, no, you're still a dishonest person. That's called compartmentalization. And little children do that kind of thing before their brain's fully developed.
And what I find is that people pleasers are, in fact, often incredibly controlling. They're trying to manage the whole relationship. They're trying to stop their partner from getting upset. So they're saying, don't get upset. Clue here, if you tell your partner not to get upset, that generally makes them more upset.
Thanks for that one. I hadn't got onto that one yet. Yeah, don't get mad. Don't get upset. You know, one of the things nice guys will tell me is they'll say, well, I don't want to hurt anybody. And I go, bullshit. You just don't want anybody mad at you because it stresses you out, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, you do things that hurt them all the time. You know, you behave in ways that hurt people. You withhold the truth in ways that hurt people. So let's kind of come off that pedestal of, oh, I'm kind. I don't want to hurt anybody. No, the truth is you're covering your own ass. You just don't want anybody mad at you because it makes you anxious. Now, as I was, you know, coming to understand nice guys and nice guy syndromes myself in writing No More Mr. Nice Guy. It took me 6-7 years to write it. And as I wrote it, I primarily talked about it developing from the concept of shame, of toxic shame. I'm not good enough. I'm bad. That's the trying to become, trying to hide. By the time I'd finished writing and continued working with nice guys, I really also came to the awareness that another key component in nice guy syndrome is anxiety. That pretty much everything a nice guy does is trying to manage their anxiety. So we're managing people and managing situations so we don't feel anxious. That's control. Right? It's very good. I'm going to control you so I don't feel anxious, or try to control that situation so I don't feel anxious. The truth is, we're always going to have things in life that make us anxious. And if we're trying to manage those things so we don't feel anxious, again, we stay in a very, very childlike way of living in the world. But when we can learn to soothe ourselves, whether it's through grounding, through breath, through affirmation that I'll handle it, through just the experience of facing fears and realizing, oh, I don't die. When we learn to soothe our anxiety, we don't have to control anything. We can kind of get into almost kind of like this Zen mindset, you know, where we're outcome agnostic. I'm equally okay with every possible outcome. Now, that's a challenge for us humans, but it's when anxiety's driving the bus, we want to control the people. So I don't want them upset because that makes me anxious. Or I don't want to get rejected. Or I don't want to lose that promotion. Or I don't want to look bad because that makes me anxious. What if we knew we could handle it?
Well, the truth is, if you're going to try and control the world, you are going to be anxious because the world is not controllable.
Well, you know, I often say that you know, the Buddha said that attachment is the cause of all suffering. And I say it's also the cause of all anxiety. Whatever we get attached to, we're going to be anxious because we can't control the world. And you know, when I talk with nice guys and they'll say something like, okay, I understand that being this passive nice guy doesn't work. And they go, but I don't want to come over here to this extreme and become, you know, the jerk, the asshole, the mean person. I want to find, you know, they always say balance. Nice guys always want balance. And I go, I don't believe in balance in most things. But they go, someplace in the middle. I go, really? But I don't know what the tipping point is between two toxic extremes. That doesn't exist. And what I tell them, that actually the nice guy and the jerk are often one and the same person, in that they're both in perpetual fight, flight, freeze. They're perpetually triggered into this response of I got to do something to manage my anxiety. The nice guy does it through fleeing and freezing and fawning, trying to make things better. The jerk over here manages their anxiety by fighting, being manipulative, being combative, being aggressive. But they're just same continuum of the exact same issue. How do I manage my anxiety? So that's why I say we don't just find some middle ground. We actually come up to another plane where we do learn to be honest, differentiated, where we do learn to soothe our anxiety rather than trying to manage it. And then when we start doing these things like the differentiation, the soothing, we actually become people of integrity. We become people that you can trust. We can become people you want to be around. We become people actually with rough edges that people can actually be attracted to.
Because one of the things I've discovered in 40 years of working with couples is that the people pleasers are actually secretly full of rage.
That tends to happen because it goes back to the covert contracts. And people will ask, well, how do you know you're in a covert contract? And I'll say, if you actually pay attention, how you know you're in covert contracts is that you tend to feel frustrated, resentful, even rageful. Now, again, because nice guys and nice girls compartmentalize, and it's not nice to feel resentful or rage, right? So we even push that back down. And so how it usually comes out is this avoidance, passive aggressiveness, which is not nice. And eventually, if it blows up and up, we swing that other side of the pendulum and we become the jerk. We become, you know, the aggressive, you know, blowing up. And then that triggers our shame. So then we swing back to the other side. I'm sorry. How can I make it better?
Because actually at the bottom of all of this is incredible low self-esteem, because there's a feeling that if we're not actually pleasing people all the time, nobody's going to like us.
And that goes back to that idea of what's called toxic shame. That's something that every human to some degree internalizes at a very early age, inaccurately internalizes. When we have painful, uncomfortable experiences, children as narcissistic beings believe we caused that. And if we caused that, we can't think this because we don't have the words. It's an emotional internal. I must be bad, unlovable, not good enough. And that becomes our machine language, our operating language as we come through adolescence and adulthood. And we all try to manage that not good enough feeling. And everybody does it in their own unique way. Nice guy syndrome is just one way of doing that. Well, I'll become what people want me to be. I'll hide what I think gets negative reaction. But it all goes back to that toxic shame. And so really the only way to truly address nice guy syndrome, nice girl syndrome, is to begin addressing that inaccurate internalization that's stored up in our emotional operating system that I'm not lovable. I'm not good enough. And the only way I know how to do that is go find safe people and to begin revealing the things about you that you've never revealed to anybody and start getting more accurate feedback. Well, that doesn't make you a bad person, or, you know, you weren't the cause of that, or you're not the problem there. And we actually begin to start releasing that toxic shame to where we can start liking ourself well enough to show up as our true self in the world.
Because I think in general, people don't really like masks. They respond more to rounded people, the person behind the mask, but that's incredibly difficult to drop the mask.
It is. And again, I tell people I work with all the time, you can't do this work alone. You can't just read a book and say, okay, I'm going to let go of my toxic shame, or I'm going to quit. Because we didn't develop these masks, this toxic shame, in social isolation. We developed them in response to uncomfortable situations, often at 2 weeks old, 2 months old, 2 years old, you know, at a very young age. So we really do need assistance to drop the mask. And, you know, one of the things that I take this as a compliment when I hear it, when people say to me, Robert, I really like how open you are. I like how authentic you are. I like how vulnerable you are. And I take that as a compliment because 35 years ago, nobody in my life would have accused me of being authentic, right? That just didn't happen. I was wearing this mask that nobody really knew the real me. And it's taken work, you know, about 30 years worth of work, and I'm still practicing it to this day, to be transparent, to be vulnerable, to let people, to be a what you see is what you get kind of guy. Yeah, and there's still parts of me that go, you know, fear will come. I can't let them see that. I can't tell them that. Yeah, sure I can. I've been doing it and I haven't died yet. So apparently you can be real. You can be vulnerable. And it is such an easier way to live than walking around these masks on.
And I mean, I think the worst of it all, and this is something I see a huge amount because, you know, most people don't arrive in my rooms until they've crashed their marriage. But often they go from to the other extreme and destroy everything.
Are you talking about their lives and their physical health, their career?
They say, they get so angry that they say something that's going to really upset. They end up having an affair. They feel that because nothing's got resolved, then, oh, F it. And then they do really destructive things.
That's how I got into my path of recovery. I did the same thing. I have this pattern of getting into relationship. And I'm an optimist. everybody's got their own flaws and their own, you know.
Because I believe you're on your third marriage, aren't you now?
I'm on my third marriage. Now, I didn't necessarily blow all of them up, but I did blow up the first one because I have this tendency. I get into relationship and I'm optimistic. I always think, well, the person's good traits will grow over time and their bad traits will minimize. It's usually the opposite is true. Most people, once they get in a relationship, their good traits disappear and their bad traits grow. Most of the time, I realize at some point, 3 months in, 3 years in, this is as far as the person was going to go in their own personal growth. It's kind of like, nope, this is it. Heels dug in. Don't expect me to become any better of a human being over, you know, just don't expect. And then I would stay another 7 years or so. And then, yeah, I mean, again, I'm the optimist. It will change. And I didn't like conflict. And so then, yeah, I would at some point, somebody else would pay attention to me. That would feel validating. It would feel good. And I'd go down that pathway because I was so compartmentalized. And I still remember maybe my first true introspective journey of truth was when I was having an affair in my first marriage with a friend of my wife.
Ooh.
And oh, yeah. Oh, it's even messier. I'm just not going into all the detail. It was messier than that. And we were both married. So, you know, and both had kids and our kids played together. Yeah, it's even messier. But, and you know, I'm going down this path. And at some moment, I asked myself, how did I get here? Now, that's a healthy question to ask. How did I get here? And you know what? It dawned on me that I'd been so out of integrity in so many areas of life for so long, this was just the next step. It was just one more step. It felt normal to not be aligned to, you know, my true self and to the truth. And so I realized I'm a good hider. I was a good liar. I was a good manipulator. And, you know, and all the while thinking, I'm a nice guy. Talk about compartmentalization. That's compartmentalization. You know, I'm grateful all that happened. You know, it hurt people. You know, we've made amends. We recovered from it, moved on, but it got me into therapy. And, you know, I, at this time, you know, you're a marriage and family therapist. I was too. My doctorate's in marriage and family therapy. I was in my 30s, already had my doctorate, was already working with couples. I'd never been to therapy. That's not real logical. One of my professors said, if you believe in therapy, go get therapy. So, if you believe in it enough to make your living doing it, go get therapy. So it got me into therapy. And luckily, I landed in some really good places. 12-step group where I did start opening it up with a really good therapist, then a men's group. And these are the places I actually started working on these issues, like being honest, making my needs a priority, having boundaries, dealing with conflict head on instead of avoiding it. And that's been an ongoing process. And it, some of those things have been challenging for me, but it is a process of just getting down to that true self and being you.
I'm sure you know the therapist, Terry Real. He said to me that therapists need therapy so much, they've turned it into their profession so they can be in therapy all the time.
I don't doubt that. I often say, you know, if you want a path to become a recovering nice guy, write a book about nice guys and work with thousands of nice guys over, you know, about 30 to 40 years of time. So yeah, I'm constantly doing my own therapy. Every time I see, you know, somebody else's dynamic behavior playing out, I'm going, I do that. Yeah, I still fall into that. Yeah, we do get to do our own therapy.
So how do you think women show up as people pleasers? Is there a difference between male people pleasers and some female people pleasers?
You know, I don't think it's really that significant of a difference. You know, when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy, as I said, nobody really addressed codependency in men. It mainly, you know, there were books out called Women That Love Too Much, you know, but most of the pleasing stuff being addressed was to, you know, again, the partners of addicts and women. And I think at least traditionally, women were kind of trained to be those pleasers, go along to get along, you know, be nice. I think that's switched a lot. I think now actually you see women becoming more and more aggressive and men becoming more and more passive. There's been just a whole paradigm shift. Yeah, I think that whole codependent model kind of began with women. And then most of the nice guys I work with, not most, I'd say, but a significant number, were trained to be pleasers by their mothers. I was. My mother was a true blue pleaser and manipulative and passive aggressive and could get angry when things didn't go her way. But that was my role model for how to be a pleaser was from my mother. I had a significant number of emails from women about my book who both say they really liked it in terms of helping them understand a man in relationship, either an ex or somebody they're with. But a lot of women tell me that they see themselves in it. And there's some places in the book where I really hone in on issues with men, especially around certain addictions, pornography, and things like that. But if you take the general principles of the book, being honest, asking for what you want, having boundaries, making your needs a priority, communicating your feelings, your thoughts, that's not male or female. That's just good human principles to live an authentic life.
Because what I find a lot is that female people pleasers are not able to ask for what they want for themselves, but they ask for what they want covertly through the children. They say, the children want you home tonight so they can see you.
You know what? A couple more examples of that. When one of my clients says something like, well, you know, I deserve to do X, blah, blah, blah. I go, actually, I'm not a big fan of the word deserve because it's a two-edged sword. If you have to convince yourself you deserve something, your mind can also convince you, no, you don't. But that's actually one of the things that marketing did to try to sell things to women. You know, you deserve a Calgon day. I mean, you're soaking your hands in dishwash soap, or you deserve a spa day. You deserve to get your nails done because you give to everybody, so you deserve. Now, actually, again, that's a two-edged sword because you can go, well, maybe I haven't given enough, so maybe I don't deserve. How about I just want? How about I want a spa day? I want a massage. I want to get my nails done. That's okay. But deserving it is one of the ways we pitch it to nice people. Oh, because, you know, it's the bad people, they get what they want, but you deserve it, right? Now, here's another one. I heard or read this a while back, that when like electric dishwashers, automatic dishwashers kind of began to get developed and they started marketing them to the homeowner, you know, to people, oh, don't wash dishes anymore by hand, get a dishwasher. The marketing tended to approach women because they assumed they were doing most of the dishes and said, you now can relax more. You will have more time to relax, less time working in the kitchen, and nobody bought them. But when they started marketing, this will kill more germs. It will keep your family healthy. It would, you know, when it's about like me taking care of other people, then all of a sudden women, you know, oh, I need a dishwasher, right? So part of that feminine is there. And I think that's the feminine, I would say the feminine in all of us. That is the part that is seeking connection, flow of love, external validation. I'm okay. I'm good enough. And so there is that piece there. Let me take care of everybody else first and get my needs met through them.
So how can you learn to please yourself rather than going through pleasing somebody else to please you? So let's go straight to the source. How do we learn to please ourselves?
That can be challenging. That sounds like a simple question. It is challenging. When I used to have my private practice, and so I'd be sitting in an office with a guy that identifies as a nice guy, and we'd start talking about making your needs a priority, pleasing yourself. And if I'd say to a guy, you need to put yourself first, because until you fill your own bucket up, you really have nothing to give to anybody else. And it's probably caretaking, not caring. You're giving what you need to give, not what they need to get. And guys will say, and this is true of women as well, I don't even know what I want. I don't even know what my needs are. And I would hand them like a legal pad, you know, to write on. And I said, let's just start making a list of things that you would like to do. And they would sit and stare at it. I can't even think of anything. And because at some age, they made an emotional decision, maybe very unconsciously, it's better if I don't have needs. Everybody else's needs are more important than mine. Everybody else's needs comes first before I get my needs met. I'm bad for having needs even. That's pretty common, right? I know I can relate to that. Or I'll get left if I have needs, or people will be mad at me if I have needs. And so even just getting a guy or a woman to write down a few things I want or need can be really challenging. And so often I'd say, what did you like doing when you were a kid? Oh, I liked riding my bike, climbing trees, you know, making art, playing with animals, you know, building stuff with Legos. I go, Let's start there. And I often ask, why'd you quit doing it? And they go, I don't know. I guess at some point I just decided I shouldn't do those things anymore. And so that's a good place to actually start. Go back to a time in life where you did get your needs and wants met and see, what did that look like? What did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, when I work with sort of women in their 50s whose children possibly have left home and sort of saying, what is it that you want?
Yeah, now you can ask, what do you want?
And even so, they feel a bit guilty of me saying, asking that question,
yeah,
you know, because they've spent their whole life putting somebody else first.
It is a challenge to make that shift. And when I bring the same subject up with men, they often get that deer in the headlights look, like, what are you asking me to do? Make my needs a priority? You know, and that really is a visceral fear that goes deep down inside. That will make me unlovable, right? That'll make me a bad person. That'll make people leave me. That'll make me like my father, you know, maybe for these women, their mother, or the bad women. You know, the gold diggers or whoever, they only think of themselves that they've been trying not to be like. So it can be a real crisis of identity to even just ask, what do I want?
And how do you help them find their personal power, their strength to actually be themselves?
Again, this goes back to something I said earlier. I don't think you can break out of this on your own. Maybe some situations, yeah, you could read a book, like in No More Mr. Nice Guy. I think there's like 50-something breaking free activities, things to go do, right, to challenge yourself, get out of your comfort zone.
Give me an example.
Well, one of them, somebody just wrote me or mentioned it the other day. One of the examples of a breaking free activity I give is I tell a guy, go travel alone, go someplace maybe you've never been before where nobody knows you, and just go travel alone. Now, for a lot of people, even just do anything says, me, plan a trip all by myself, I can't do that. I have to take somebody. I can't justify me, you know, going on a trip by myself. But by traveling somewhere, maybe even especially a place where it's a culture very foreign to you or language that you don't speak, forces you to get resourceful, to get your needs met. It takes you out of a familiar environment where you play familiar roles every day, wear familiar masks. It takes you away from the people that you're used to interacting with in, you know, these predetermined unconscious ways. So you go away and travel, and almost everybody that does this will report back some stories, just great stories of some risks they took, people they met, adventures they have, you know, got in a boat and went somewhere, got in a taxi and ended up here, got on a train, missed their stop, but had this, you know, they have some grand adventure and a sense of confidence that, you know, I can live life on my terms. You know, one of the things, this may sound really paradoxical, but in my first two marriages, I stayed with my two wives for a total of 25 years. And I've often said I should not have dated either one of them more than three dates. But I tend to get, I'm a bad ender. I mean, that's not a good life skill. It's an essential life skill, but it's not one of my stronger ones. And I just kept trying to make it better, And what I realized that part of, probably the biggest part of it was, I'd never really been alone as an adult. And there's this unconscious fear of being alone. Now, the irony of that was, is that I think underneath the fear was, I don't know if I can handle it. I don't know if I can take care of myself alone. I've been taking care of people all my life. And so the irony was, not only was I often doing enough to take care of me, but enough to take care of a partner and more than one child. So I knew I was competent at taking care of multiple people, but I didn't think I could just take care of me alone by myself. And it wasn't until, you know, and when I got out of my second marriage, I was in my late 40s. I'd never lived alone as an adult. And it took probably at least a couple of years to really get it. I'm okay. I'm all right. I can take care of me. And I actually really learned to love living alone and being on my own and having these adventures by myself. Now, but going back to a question that you asked just a moment ago, how do we get there? You know, I mentioned the breaking free activity, but here's one thing I'll say. I really believe we need support to make these kind of significant changes. We need a coach. We need a therapist. We need a support group. We need a best friend, you know, a pastor, a rabbi, a mentor, because most of these things, we will not take those leaps on ourselves, by ourselves. I wanted, after I'd gotten from my divorce from my second marriage and living alone, I discovered Mexico while in my second marriage and kept thinking, I want to live here. It's rainy in Seattle. It's like the UK, gray, rainy, love the sunshine being here in Mexico. And, you know, it took me 10 years, again, out of fear. I'll kind of handle it, how will I do it, how can I have my business, how will I make a living? And then a friend of mine, just during the recession, his business went under, his construction business, so 2007, 2008, he just went to Mexico and was doing just fine. And he came back and we went out and saw a ball game together, baseball game, and, you know, had a drink and talked. And I thought, if he can do it, I can do it. And so, you know, if it was just left alone, my fears would have taken over. But in the context of another person who's doing it, who might support me, encourage me, it makes it easier to take those what seem like big steps, bold steps.
So in a moment, we're going to be looking at a letter that I've been sent in.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
If you'd like to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life, go to my website, www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcasts, and you'll find details of how to become a supporter and also how to write in to The Meaningful Life with a dilemma for us. And here's the one I have for today. I've spent much of my adult life moving around, normally for my husband's job, but once because I had a great opportunity. The children are grown and we're both reaching retirement or working less and being able to work remotely, so we can decide where to settle once and for all. I want to put down roots, preferably back in the UK, Yorkshire, where I grew up, but I would also like Barcelona, where I have fond memories from our 40s. However, my husband wants to keep options open and try somewhere new. He favours Mexico or South America. I can't face making another set of friends. Not that I know many people still in Yorkshire and Barcelona, or finding new doctors, dentists, etc. I don't want to have the loft or cellar brim full of boxes ready for the next move. I want to throw them all away. To make matters worse, my husband has no patience for my put-down roots talk. How can I be homesick all of a sudden when I left the UK 40-odd years ago? I want retirement to be a time of coming together, not a source of stress.
I have great empathy for the experience that the woman's writing about. You know, there's so many moving pieces in this. It sounds simple. You know, do we go here and retire? Or do we? But it's not simple. There's a lot of moving parts to it. And you know, as a relationship therapist, there's kind of the cardinal rule of relationship therapy is the thing that people are fighting about is usually not the thing that they're fighting about. It's usually something else. It's the metaphor, right? That gives them. And so it could be that this situation gives them something to have conflict about because maybe they need to have conflict. It could be that the woman has given up too many of her wants and desires to maybe an overbearing husband who has no patience with her having wants and desires. Could be that's been going on for a long time. It could be things that she feels like she's missed out on life and wants to go have some of that. And maybe the husband's afraid of missing out. And so there's a lot of moving pieces. And one of the thoughts that I had is that, you know, in talking about just masculine, feminine energies, and we all have a masculine side, we all have a feminine side, but the masculine does. The masculine wants to conquer. And the feminine wants connection and the flow of love. And we all have, you know, that to some degree. It sounds like she's very much in her feminine. Maybe the kids are gone, so there's no connection and flow of love. She's wanting to go someplace where she feels like she could be connected. Maybe there'd be make new friends there, not having to keep breaking connections and making new friends. She's wanting connection, flow of love. It could be she would really like more connection and flow of love with her husband. I don't know. And it could be that he wants more adventure, more things to conquer, more things to master, new adventures, unknown. That's more of the masculine path. And, you know, a beautiful book that I would even recommend to the woman in this case that I really love is called A Home of My Own. And it's written by a woman named Sandra Cisneros, beautiful writer. She's you know, won many awards for writing. And she wrote a book for children called The House on Mango Street, which is just a beautiful book for kids.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, so that's Sandra Cisneros. Her family is Latina. She grew up in Chicago, but her parents came directly from Mexico. And so the book is a number of just essays, short stories, poetry, biography about trying to find a home of her own, a house of her own. And she ended up in San Miguel, Mexico, where I've been. And it's a beautifully written book. And I think it does show the cravings of the feminine for that connection, right? Something solid, something that's not always changing and being disrupted. I know I bought a house here in Mexico after losing my second lease on condos that I liked living in. I thought, I don't want to ever have anybody kick me out of my house again, right? And I'm not the super adventurous type that wants to keep going to a lot of different places. But I do know, I'm 68, that I think there is a certain phase or developmental phase that people go through when now they have more choices than they used to. And what do we do with those choices? Do we go settle down, get a little cottage here, or do we get an RV, or do we, you know, timeshares, or do we just move around? And I think that can create individual crisis, not alone crisis between two people. Now, to paraphrase Einstein, he said the thinking that got us into the problem we're in is not going to get us out of the problem. I have a hunch this person that wrote, her and her husband, whatever patterns they've had throughout a long relationship, however they've learned to work, solve conflicts, make decisions, may not serve them anymore. They're probably going to need some new models for resolving differences. And, you know, again, I'm a big fan. Don't do it alone. Go find somebody that could help both people express the depth of their desire. Not just, I want a home in Yorkshire. I want to be able to go to South America. What's beneath all that desire? What's the depth of connection?
Yeah, I agree that nearly always when people are stuck, you need to go deeper with the actual issue that we're talking about.
Always. It's just a portal. It's just a doorway into something deeper.
And there seems to be two, and I think you've identified them beautifully, two tensions. There's our tension because we need adventure and we also need security. And how are we going to get both of these things? Instead of, you know, for example, you representing security and your husband potentially representing adventure, how can you actually have both of those things?
To the degree that you are inspired by both of those things.
And you don't have to spend all your time together. You know, you could stay at home and have some security, and he could go off and go on a crew to sail around the world for 3 months or something like that. You know, you don't have to do everything in your retirement together. Like, you most probably weren't in Mexico to know about Millie and Pilly, who were a sort of like 70s TV sitcom from Spain and was shown in Mexico a lot, where these twins wore the same clothes and did absolutely everything together, normally dance routines. So you don't have to leave your life like Pilly and Millie.
And that's fusion that you're talking about. And most couples have a strong degree of fusion. Western culture, well, Eastern culture even more. Well, you get in a relationship, basically, I say, you put the handcuff on your wrist, give it to your partner, let them put it on their wrist, and give them the key, and then resent them because they've taken away your freedom, your ability to live life on your terms. Apparently, you know some Spanish, and I'll ask Spanish speakers this question. And a person whose first language is Spanish but also speaks English, and I can ask them in English, is always surprised by this. I'll ask them, how do you say wife in Spanish? Well, it's esposa. And, you know, how do you say plural of wives? Esposas. And then I'll ask them, how do you say handcuffs And they'll look and get that look, and they'll go, esposas. The word in Spanish for handcuffs is wives, right? And it's kind of like if you grow up with that, you know, we grow up with language and we don't really, you know, break it down. You grow up saying esposas and not even thinking of that connection. You know, in English, we might say the ball and chain, but, you know, that could refer to any partner. But here's the beauty of differentiation. I've long believed, I'm not a big fan of compromise, because usually when we have what's called compromise, one of two things. One person's usually caved, and so it's not a compromise. They didn't get any of what they wanted. Or in the compromise, both people walk away at least a little bit unhappy. Now, what if you have a long-term relationship, even just 5 years, 10 years, maybe in this couple, 30 or 40 years together? How many, quote, compromises have they made where both walked away at least a little bit unhappy? And then how does those little bricks of unhappiness start building up into the relationship until now we end up, you know, writing a letter to somebody that does a podcast and say, help me, you know, the wall has gotten really big. But here I'm a big fan, and often we need help to do this. Again, sometimes we can do it on our own. You know, you and I might could sit down and just put out the depth of our desire, the depth of what we want. I want this. This, I want it to look like this. I want it to be this. You could do the same. And often what can happen if both people, they're not holding back, put down the depth of their desire, don't hold in, and just boldly, just like, often some interesting thing trickles up that hadn't even entered consciousness. Now, sometimes we do need help to do that. Like you could say, could you get a home here? And you spend part of your year here, and you know, he goes and does this, and you make your friends, and usually our fear is, well, they won't come back, you know, or, you know, but often then what happens, though, maybe you get down to the bottom of it, of maybe they really don't even like each other, and he doesn't want to spend all that much time living in some house feeling trapped by this woman. So if you can get down to what's real, you can get stuff, and then maybe you just find out, because like, for example, one of the things that I've been working on in my marriage with my wife, we've been married 7.5 years now. She's Mexican. And so I got to learn Spanish in order to have this relationship, which has been fun. I started thinking two, 3 years ago, going back to the esposas thing. How could I be in a monogamous relationship with this person and not give up any other personal freedoms to be in the relationship? Still sexually monogamous. But not give up it, because I give up my freedoms. I don't even, my wives don't even take them away from me. My wife, Lupita, never says, you can't go on that trip. You know, last year when I went to Berlin, where I met you, she didn't say, you can't go to Berlin, or if you go there, you have to take me. Never. She never does that. But I always think, I can't have a spa day. I can't go to Berlin by myself. You know, I went to London last year. I can't go to London by myself. Or I can't go to the desert with my men's group, or I can't just go visit my granddaughter on her birthday. And the funny thing is, my wife encourages those things. She's never said no to me. But, you know, I got the handcuff I gave her, and I gave her the key because I'm afraid of that kind of freedom, whatever my deeper stuff is I've had to work on, right? And so my wife and I have a mantra that we started saying to each other really just a couple of years ago. And that is, you're free. And you belong to me. And really, the belong to me is just an owning. You know, you have my heart. This is home. I'm always here. And you are free to go face your fears, to go have your adventures. My wife has been, she's danced since she was a little girl. Salsa, bachata, cumbia. She loves since she started taking lessons about a year or so ago. And she now is out at her lessons 4 nights a week, Monday through Thursday night. And then usually goes to some social, some dance program Friday or Saturday night. Sometimes she went to dance class last night, got home, changed clothes, went out with some girlfriends to a music venue where they had cumbia, live music. And I think she got in about 2:30 this morning. And you know, she's loving her life. And who am I to say you can't go do what you love? Sometimes she'll go, I don't think I'm going to go to class tonight. I go, yeah, you are. You always come home happy. She goes, okay. So we have this bond. We're here for each other. Neither one of us ever wants to go anywhere else. I don't want to be with anybody else. but I know she needs those kind of adventures. Okay, that's her freedom. My freedom is I'm going to Austin, Texas next month. I'm going to go do a retreat with men there and then do about half a dozen interviews, live interviews with people in Austin, Texas. In June, I'm going to get to go be a speaker at a retreat up in Northern California. I get all these opportunities and adventures, and I usually build in there some either alone time for myself, or you know, I get up and visit my mother as often as I can. I try to visit my son, visit my granddaughter as much as I can. And so that's my freedom, to go spend time with guys, by myself, with mother, son, a granddaughter. And she has her freedoms, go dance, to go have fun with other people. And I'm not jealous or insecure because I know she belongs to me. She's always coming home. And so it's really let us both flourish tremendously.
So thank you for being a witness on The Meaningful Life. And as a witness, I have to ask you, what makes your life meaningful?
What makes my life meaningful? Making a difference. I love knowing I'm making a difference. I love when people invite me on interviews and say, Robert, I read your book and it changed my life. I love it when people send me emails and say, you not only changed my life, you saved my life. I like knowing that I make a difference. That gives me, that's meaningful to me. You know, people say, you probably hear this all the time. I say, no, go ahead, say it. I like hearing it.
More.
Tell me I changed your life. Tell me how your life is so much better since you read my book. You know, I'm okay. Tell me. I've heard a lot, but tell me some more.
Well, this is where we're going to finish, unless you are a supporter of The Meaningful Life, because we're going to talk about people pleasers at work. So if you want to find out more about that and hear the bonus material, you can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. If you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and unlock the bonus material this way, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.